Okay, so I gather some of you have actually finally started the assignment. There's a rumor going around to that effect. That was my impression, judging by the emails I got. What?
This morning.
I haven't seen those emails yet. I've gotten various bug reports from Scott. There have been a number of capital bugs that have caused him confusion. There's also been some theory of operation bugs, and I gather some intrepid soul tried to use kprintf in the middle of their processing loop and discovered that it wipes out some of their capabilities, which I just want to tell you, it's not supposed to do. Now, if people send me bug reports, there's a chance that these things get straightened out. But if I get the reports on Monday morning for an assignment that's due Tuesday, there's no chance that this stuff gets straightened out in time to be helpful. It was expected that there would be a learning curve here, which is why I was trying to get you guys to download a system and at least start trying to build it 4 weeks ago. When you did. Well, no, two of you did. I know who you are. Okay, so I want to ask people what they're running into. And let me explain, the capital is young code. There's a new back end to it. We know there are bugs in it in abstract. We don't necessarily know where. So if there's some weird behavior going on, like, well, I added a kprintf and all of a sudden my returns aren't working, we need to hear about it so we can fix it. Okay.
My roadblock was I wanted two cases. Either it would idle the CPU or it would return, it would succeed either in the last code, last line in the initial line. Or else it was when trying to invest the CR log.
Okay, let me explain what's going on with the idle the CPU part. There are a couple of different scenarios there that people have run into. Big one, I think, is, well, let's see. There's a reply protocol you have to do in your initialize routine. So were you doing the reply create call? And do you have any reason to believe that the capability that you were sending back was valid?
I literally copy-pasted and typed out all of the handling.
Well, famous last words.
Yeah.
And I've spoken them too. I don't mean that in any snide way.
Right.
Okay, so look, the strategy is saying, let me cut and paste from Text Console and then try to take out the extraneous stuff and then work out from there is a plausible strategy. What's become a I only learned about the kprintf in the process request loop problem an hour ago. Okay, so I had no hope in hell of fixing it for you. You were experiencing.
Can you say what that problem is?
Okay, the story I have, so right now what I have is hearsay, but here's what the hearsay is. And you know how hearsay, right? Every time you add another layer to it, it gets more hearsay-like. That somebody attempted to put a kprintf in the middle of their process request loop with the result that it was overwriting their reply capability and therefore something that basically worked at least in some cases before they put in the kprintf. Spontaneously stopped working when the kprintf went in. Is the person who ran into this here, am I getting the story correct? You have a mystery guest. It may have been you, actually. I don't remember.
I put kprintfs in process request and didn't have that particular problem. That had no effect on my problem.
Okay, this time. I'm not going to go there, you know. Oh, sorry. You kind of walked into that one. Okay, so the story I got, it sounded like the kprintf call might have been overwriting a capability in a bad way. And I'm going to go look at the stub code for kprintf, but that seems, I mean, it's certainly not supposed to be doing that. I won't go so far as to say it won't, but I suspect it's not because we've been using kprintf enough that if it had had this effect, I would hope we would have noticed. Okay, so there are a couple of things going on that might be impeding a reply. And unfortunately, the constructor request case is one of these cases which is not in this list. So I'm actually kind of puzzled about what's going on there. The big one is if you have a string, okay, there's an asymmetric relationship between a client and a server. Let me motivate the problem before I explain what the effect is that may be biting you. Look, if I'm a client and I call a server in order to get some service to happen, I'm saying in part, implicitly, In order for me to operate correctly, I have to rely on the behavior of this thing that I'm calling. Because if I didn't have to rely on it, I wouldn't have called. And part of that is, well, I'm relying on it to behave in some reasonable and sensible fashion. What? Laughing back there? And in particular, I'm saying, I trust it. Not trust in the sense that I'm going to disclose to it everything I know, but trust in the sense that I expect that if I call it, it's going to return in an orderly way. So, generally speaking, a client-to-server call is a blocking call in the sense that if I can't make progress immediately, I'm willing to block in order to make progress. Maybe the server is off doing something for somebody else at the moment. Right? But not only do I trust it to return to me, I trust that it will accept my request eventually. Unfortunately, this is not true when the server responds to me. There are two kinds of servers, broadly speaking, in the world. There are servers that have an exclusive relationship with the client, and simply because they only serve one client, the issue I'm about to describe doesn't really arise. Then there are servers that have multiple clients. The problem is, if you're a client and you're calling me, you rely on me. There's no marginal exposure in blocking until I'm available to serve you. Fortunately, the reverse is not true. If I'm a multi-client service, I have clients calling me left and right, it could be that one of them is hostile, and the reason it's calling me is to contrive for me to stop operating. And one of the ways it can contrive for me to stop operating is by arranging not to accept a reply. For example, it could do a send that I think incoming is a call, and then simply not do the receive thing. Or it could do the send, and then it could sit in an infinite loop. And if it sits in an infinite loop, it will never enter the receiving state. If it never enters the receiving state, I would not make progress trying to send it a response. If I don't make progress and on the server, I'm now blocked indefinitely, and no other client will ever make progress again. So return part is non-blocking. You need to be careful. It's not that return operations are inherently non-blocking. Return is a description of what's going on at the procedure call layer. Both of these are sends. One of them is a blocking send, the other one is a non-blocking send. The question about a non-blocking send is, what are the guarantees? Okay. Well, if the receiver's not listening, we're done. No message will get through. But assume that the receiver is waiting, or receiving, excuse me, old term waiting. Assume the receiver is receiving, what are the guarantees on a non-blocking send? Anything that is transmitted as one of the data words, which we used to call registers, but they're no longer all in registers, will get through. Because there's nothing in the transport that might take a fault while attempting to move the registers. Any capability whose destination is a capability register. Are you able to get stuff out of the trunk too? Cool. Anything whose destination is a capability register will get through. And because there's nothing in this picture that could take a fall. Capability that's going to a memory location may or may not get through. It will get through if, and only if, destination memory location is valid for writing, in this case for writing a capability, in the receiver's address space. So another way to say that is, the receiver would have to run a memory fault handler in order for this location to be good. That will not happen, and the message will be truncated. Same issue with data streams. The reason is, if I'm a server and I'm sending a message to you, look, I don't trust you, that's why I'm doing non-blocking in the first place. I don't trust your memory handler either, because you're in control of what it does. And there are lots of ways that I could get blocked. One of them is you could not be listening, but the other is that your memory handler could not be listening. I can't allow any of that mechanism to run. So the rule is that the kernel, as a special case, will do object paging. If the memory location is defined properly, but it's been paged out, the kernel will bring it back in. But it will not execute the fault handling protocol at application level. Fault handler will not run. Of course, if you're not in the receiving state, when I go to do a non-blocking send, the non-blocking send, it goes to the messaging gods. And as with all gods, they ignore messages sent to them. Your denomination may feel differently. I'm looking for evidence. So one possible cause of the reply protocol ending up in the idle loop is that the receiver wasn't listening. Okay. The second possible cause, and this one's actually quite likely, is a fault got delivered somewhere in this protocol. Now, there's a problem in the way that we're currently building these utilities that we're not putting in a process handler at all. So the question now is, what happens if a process takes a fault and there's no process handler? The answer is, it ceases to execute instructions violently. Basically, the process is now in a state where it is running, attempting to deliver a fault with no place to send it, and it will stay in that state. And is not eligible for scheduling when it's faulted. That's one possibility. Second possibility. Third possibility is somehow the reply capability that you invoked is no longer a reply capability, or perhaps never was a reply capability. So, one of the things that I failed to say explicitly and should have, some of the capability registers have uses that are well known to the low-level runtime system. Right, the low-level runtime has to be able to allocate storage. It has to know where to get to your space bank. So by strong convention, there's a capability register, which is where you put your space bank capability. If you overwrite that, pieces of the runtime will stop working. And that's why we have a macro CR app. Do not try pronouncing that out loud. He's a little slow here. So what are the conventions? Here's the capability register file, okay? Capability register 0 is always null. It is not writable. A convention, and I do not recall which one is which, so don't hold me to that part. The last 8 registers, 4 for incoming capabilities, 4 for outgoing capabilities. The leading capabilities are uses that are defined by the runtime. So in MakeImage, when you do the import of Kyodos.runtime, the main thing that you're importing is the enumeration, which tells you what registers are what in that early list. Stuff in the middle, and I don't remember how many it is offhand, it's 8 or 9, that's visible for the application. In addition to these, you have a capability page off on the side, which is the tools page. So why have a tools page? In some respects, it would be simpler if applications could just come into the world with capabilities in their registers already. And we haven't yet put in the support for that. We only need 5 or 6 capabilities, that's a fine way to go. The constructor doesn't currently know how to do that. So the alternative is that the constructor stashes capabilities in a tools page, and one of your runtime slots points off to that tools page. And you fetch things out of the tool slots and bring them into your capability registers where you can use them. That's certainly the common convention, but there's another way to use them. You'll see in the existing code, you'll see calls to cap copy early in the initialization routine that are basically lifting things out of the tools page into your registers so that they can be referenced directly. But another thing you could choose to do is simply map the tools page into your memory space. You could reference those things from memory locations. Not chewing up capability registers for them. Some of you, Nate, who's not here yet, ran into an issue where he had an incoming capability going into a catalog that he had not initialized. So the thing to understand about catalogs is, capability parameters are a little bit funny. Because what I describe at the procedure call interface when I'm passing a capability across a process boundary, I'm not actually providing the capability itself in the argument. I'm providing the location of the capability, its address or its register number. So I can't actually reference the capability bits themselves. I can only tell the kernel which ones to send. Well, the same way, when I receive a capability back, I'm providing the location at which the incoming capability should be stored when the receive happens. Initialize that location, I do not know where the capability will go, and neither do you. It will go to, you know, whatever garbage bits happen to appear on the stack at that point. You're passing around an uninitialized variable. In some cases, we'll have the misfortune to get lucky. Meaning, it'll turn out that location on the stack is 0. Because the low-level protocol says, if you have a capability incoming that you do not want, The way to reject it, two ways you can reject it. One is to say, well, you want to send me four, but I only want to take two, and you'll only get two, and that's the end of it. But the other possibility is to say, you want to send four, I'm going to take zero and one, and I'm going to send two and three into my capability register zero, which has the effect of throwing them away silently. So if you had an uninitialized location that chanced to be zero, chances are good the capability did come over and got thrown out because that was what you unintentionally said to do. If you got lucky, you had random bits there, in which case what happened was the capability tried to get written to some unspecified memory location and you took a memory fall. Unfortunately, since we didn't set things up with a process handler, nobody's going to tell you you took a memory fall. Something that we should fix. In fact, it was my intention on Friday to build at least a trivial process fault handler that it would at least get far enough to say, hey, your process faulted, and you know, here's the fault code and the fault information. And even knowing that, the problem with this, you know, the scheduler went idle is, so what happened? At least if you had a fault handler, it would tell you what you faulted. That would eliminate one class of mysteries. Another thing we could do, I'm reluctant to do this, is I could add some diagnostic code into the kernel so that certain corner cases that the path checks for, if it discovers them, it will at least bitch and whine about them so that you can see what went wrong and ask, now, why should that have happened? And I've been of two minds. On the one hand, that's a really useful mode to have, especially when you're trying to sort of learn your way around. The problem is we can't have it in a production system, because in the production system, there's nowhere for those messages to go. Production systems, by and large, don't have consoles. I've got to figure out what to do about that. And well, the other thing I should say, in this non-blocking case, paging but not fault handling in the receiver. If there's a fault on the sender side, that will still be processed in the normal way. So the assumption is if you are the program sending and you have some runtime environment that supports you, you depend on your runtime environment already. There's no problem with invoking your runtime environment to support you. There's a problem with invoking the other guy's runtime environment who you don't know. One of the things I said in the first couple of weeks is one of the differences in trying to design really robust systems is you ask, well, okay, I have a specification. Now, how would I go about abusing this specification, either to trip up some corner case that was underspecified or to cause higher-level system behavior that would be unfortunate, undesirable, right? And this non-blocking thing is a mess, right? The alternative is to use some kind of a timeout, which is what L4 does. I'm often tempted to switch because this non-blocking thing is a nightmare. Let me tell you, the fix is, look, as long as, if you want to accept the string, all you've got to do is touch the locations before you receive there. And that'll guarantee that the string area is valid. Nate ran into a case where he used a cap alloc temp or something like that, which is a library routine that gives him a temporary memory location to hold the capability, and there was a bug in the library. It wasn't touching the page the first time. And so in his case, he ended up with a location that was invalid. The capability went off to Never Never Land. And in that particular case, I have to go look at the transport, I think it's the case that if the capabilities get truncated on the way through, you do actually get an error bit in the status word on the receiver side saying, hey, we dropped some of your message. I think what's going on is the current stubs aren't checking for that. They clearly should be. Okay, so if you want to actually get these things, basically you have to pre-probe the memory locations. And as of Monday sometime, there's now code in Capital that if there's a string coming back, Capital will pre-probe the string. Other cases for the scheduler going idle, I'd have to look at case by case. The most likely one is that you somehow didn't end up with the reply capability in the right place. And so then, if you manage to be replying on a null capability, which is the most likely case if it wasn't initialized, what you would discover is, well, reply to null. So what's the kernel specification? Right? A reply, it's a send. Okay? And the kernel specification says, well, the kernel, it's always, as far as you can tell, it's always receiving. It's going to do whatever your message tells it to do, and then it's going to reply to wherever you told it to reply. Well, if you do a send on a null capability, and you don't stick a reply capability in the fourth slot, in the right slot, what will happen is the kernel will invoke the null capability. It will do nothing, which is what the null capability does. It will then attempt to reply to the reply capability, which is not present, at which point it simply drops the reply on the floor. Whereupon, everybody goes idle. The kernel debugger at this point can be your friend. And I will send out a note giving you the name of the data structure. But basically, assume for a minute that I know the object ID of the process that is invoking. If I don't know that, there's a kernel variable called current. Actually, strictly speaking, it's a procedure. And this kernel variable always points to the currently executing process. I can print it, and in particular, I can print its capability registers, and I can look at their values, and I can see what I've got. So one thing you can do is you can say, well, what I should do is I should breakpoint invoke a capability routine inside the kernel. What's going on? You discover that you'll do several thousand of those, and that would be really old really fast. And so the next move is to say, well, what I'll do is I will I'll breakpoint the routine that implements the kernel lock, kprintf. Breakpoint inside the kernel, the start of the kprintf routine. And we'll stick a kprintf just before the point where I want to really debug something. That'll get the kernel to stop at the kprintf. Now I know the next call is going to be the one that I care about, and now I will breakpoint the invoke capability. I'll be looking at the one that I want, or at least I'll want to start it. Swerve, you got to say something? Other reasons that your reply went to nowhere, I would simply be speculating.
Changing your from OK
to... But what other option did you change to?
Specifically,
so the way this works in the stubs is that if the handler returns request error, actually, if it returns anything other than OK, the server-side wrapper builds a different control word. So basically, the deal is that from the server perspective, there are two kinds of messages you could be sending back. One is the normal one, the other is the exception one. And it used to be the case that in all of these messages, the first word was the result code, and then the rest of the message followed. That chewed up a ridiculous amount of space. It's the overwhelming majority of messages, the result code is OK. So we switched over to a bit, and the bit is in the control word. It's actually it's a bit that only has meaning to the application, but there's space for it reserved in the control word, which basically tells us whether this is the OK reply or the non-OK reply, and that tells us which way to demultiplex the message. It shouldn't have caused you to go idle. If you were checking the result on the client side, just like the check macro,
yeah,
what you should have seen was a complaint at that point. How do you know that?
Because it never got to check. The check never failed, and the kprintf immediately following the check.
Okay, but there are two possible errors there. One is you never got back to the client. The other is you got back to the client where the client ended up in a faulted state which it didn't report to anybody. So we don't actually know whether that invocation completed is the problem. This is why I've been thinking, what diagnostics should I put in to help sort these things out? There are a few that might help. So it's this stuff is hard to debug, and it doesn't help matters if we don't have a decent debugger yet. Yeah.
That issue, debug the MKI file.
Right.
Is there a way to debug the
MKI file? Debug the MKI file?
For
no.
For instance, if I have errors
in what do you mean if you have drivers in
like load small, you can do the text.
If you're using load small, you've already made a mistake.
No, when I was doing the text console. Today,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So then if you're trying to copy, for instance, if you had a debug.
Doesn't MakeImage issue a complaining diagnostic in that case? So MakeImage is pretty good about whining when you've done something wrong. But it can't debug. So no, there's no make image debugger. So the problem is debugging algorithms usually, debugging arrangements. There are, however, some tools in make image that can help. There's a print command in make image, which can, what's that?
Print space.
There's also print space, which will print a tree. But there's also just print. Print can be pointed at just about anything, and it will print that data structure. And there's also right, so you can say some expression. You can say, this is by way of looking like CD reference, but it isn't. So the case where this one is useful is, so this one is, you hand it a capability and it prints the capability in sort of human readable form. This one is, you want to print the object that the capability names. Okay. And if you hand print star something that doesn't really be referenced conceptually, it will tell you. I mean, it does something vaguely reasonable. Not be what you expected, but at least it'll be obvious that it wasn't what you expected. And then a print space will be, it will show you the entire memory tree. There are actually two variants of this. There's a print space, and I think there's a print tree, dump tree or something, that will, one of them shows you what the space looks like in the object sense, and the other one shows you what the space looks like in the sense that it goes page by page, and tells you what are the permissions and what are the pages in each location. If you're looking to find out what the built-ins are, something that we should add and have not, and it only just occurred to me, is a help command would be. In CCS MakeImage, most of these commands are wired up in one of the if you look in CCS MakeImage, you'll see some files named something like built-in something. A lot of each of those built-in files, there's some unbelievably ugly lines of code that are adding bindings. So this is where the interpreter's name, so this print is a name, right, as far as the interpreter is concerned. There's a C procedure that implements it, and there's a binding that gets built in built-in.cxx. So the list of bindings is the list of commands. So if you're, I mean, it's obviously not the preferred answer to go look at the source code to find out what the commands are. The documentation is at least half-assed. But if you really get stuck, you know, the code does what it does in spite of what the documentation says. So going and looking at the built-in files is at least definitive. There are more built-ins than there ought to be. What else did people run into? There's apparently a lot of mysteries with things not replying. Yeah.
In the same problem, I'm not able to come back to the client program. Then I had done the make discipline on the source folder. Then I'm not able to come back to the client program.
Sorry, then what?
I had done make discipline on the source folder, the main tree folder. Then I'm able to come back to the client program.
What do you mean you are able to come back? After a make discipline and a remake, you were able, then it worked.
Yes.
Okay, so several people were sending in bug reports Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and I was actually sending out repairs. And there were various emails that went, do an update. And usually what was getting updated over the weekend, this particular weekend, was capital. Well, the problem with capital is that when you update capital, there's a whole bunch of generated files that have to get rebuilt. Anytime you update capital or make image, you basically have to rebuild the whole tree. So what's most likely is either you had a stale file and you had done an update, you may or may not have realized that you had a stale file, and then the make disk clean followed by the make is what really cleaned up your tree. I also, by the way, changed the tree so that the documentation tree is no longer built by default. That probably has saved people a bunch of time. That in Ccache will save you, makes rebuilding the tree almost painless. 2 minutes to rebuild the whole tree. What's that?
Okay.
Oh, on CS4, you're right. On CS4, you think it may be longer. I think, I mean, on my laptop. But. Get a real laptop. 1 minute on CS4?
1 minute.
Yes, yeah, so CS418 has far more memory than a human should be allowed, which is good because it's not human. And that helps a lot. I just out of curiosity, what laptop are you using?
What's the processor? 1.8 gigahertz.
Okay, the gig of RAM is your friend, but the, but yeah, it's an older processor. It's just not a lot we can do. I'm surprised, though, it's that slow. It's a single core? Yeah, the tree's too big to fit in a RAM disk in that configuration. So, that actually, looking at cases, it's hard to debug the rest. What I maybe should do, I've sort of been thinking that I should come in and kind of do a session to take on problems that people are having and try to help sort them out. And what I didn't think to do when we started the class was get people's schedules to figure out when the hell we could do that. In principle, I would do it Tuesday night, except that I would get divorced. And you guys are worth a lot to me, but not that much. So it's probably best for most people's schedules to do it in the evening, just because that's least likely to interfere with the class. I don't want to chew up your dating time, but. Hey, you're a computer scientist, it's not me. I can't believe I said that. I'm just going to stop there. You know, would a Thursday evening work? If we can either get this room or the lab?
That may be good, or that may be bad.
You can deal with all the hard questions.
I can just confuse everyone enough.
Well, that too. I'm going to do a special help session for Scott before his office hours. You know, would a Thursday evening work, say, around abstract? I'd like to do 6, but I have to eat on schedule, so I'm going to have to say probably 7-ish. Who would not be able to do that if we did this? Are you the only person? Is anybody else? Would that be a problem if we did? I mean, is it this Thursday or Thursday in general? Yeah, if it's one person I'm going to, and I'm going to say come to my office. I'm not going to leave you in the dark, but at least not. Okay. Let me make sure I can get a room, but I believe this room is actually Thursdays, and the projector kind of works. Now. See how you can make things work if you get all of the hits in for sure. Okay. Question I was going to ask. Oh, people run into main file issues. Two things, and that's a polite way to say it. Two things to say about that. One is that the whole makefile mess is still actively under development. There's far too much magic in the makefiles because otherwise you end up replicating lots and lots of stuff. And then when you change something, you forget someplace. And a makefile that is outright wrong is worse than a makefile that's complicated, especially if it's indetectably wrong. One of the areas where we haven't got the dependency tracking right yet is in the IDL generator, and here's the problem. Conceptually, the headers that come out of IDL are part of a public interface. So they're a public interface in the same way that standard IODIH is a public interface. And versioning something like standard IODIH is a nightmare. And versioning IDL interfaces is a nightmare for all the same reasons. It's just a really hard problem. Our build model is that, so the good news is if you, there are two ways that one can manage IDL files. One is you could say, okay, I'm building a program. I will generate exactly the IDL files that I need locally. I'll ignore the ones that are installed officially. And then when I regenerate my build tree, I can do the dependency structure and get them generated. That works. The problem is what you then discover is that every program in the tree regenerates the same IDL files over and over and over and over and over and over again. The next answer is to say, well, I'll take all the IDL files for the base package, I'll put them in an IDL directory, and I will batch process them. And I'll throw them over the wall in the Kyoto's user include IDL. This has the advantage that I don't make them 15 million times for all values of 15 million. And the problem with this is that once you throw them over the wall, they get commingled with IDL files that came from other places. And knowing which ones to delete if you have to regenerate the tree, it's a bit tricky. So the particular problem is not so much when you're regenerating the IDLs, but if an IDL's name changes or it gets deleted, the old header file will linger in the installed tree unless the installed tree gets whacked. And that's what MakeThisClean does. And there is, I think, I gotta go look, there used to be a target in the makefile. And I don't know if it's still there, and it may have been renamed, but this will at least give you a hint of what to look for. There used to be a target called make targeter clean. What that would do is delete the output directories. It doesn't delete the build directories in the build tree, it only deletes the install directories. So what make dist clean actually does, if you look at the makefile in source, I believe you'll be able to figure out what the incantation is, but I think what make dist clean actually does is it does a make clean followed by a make targeter clean, or maybe them in the other order. Does the targeter clean first? Okay. So if you don't want to go rebuilding your whole tree, the option is just to make targeter clean, because that will guarantee that everything that can't be really tracked terribly well is wiped out and you're forced to start it over. We've seen cases, so there's actually two ways in which this can go wrong. You rename an IDL file, right? The old header file is dangling around. So you whack the header file, and now you've got to rebuild something. And the thing that you're rebuilding, right? You didn't make clean on that. Fine. Problem. There's makefile magic to track dependencies to make sure that when you touch a header, everything that depends on it gets rebuilt. The dependency file will still have a reference to this old header file that no longer exists. And you will suddenly discover that the build fails because it can't find the header file. And after scratching your head for a while, it will occur to you that maybe it can't find this header file because the header file shouldn't exist. This is a false error. And at this point, 8-K no depend is your friend. No depend will throw out the dependency information recursively from wherever you do it. Now the dash K is the catch. Unfortunately, when the dependency information is messed up, make will fail loading the dependency information. And then if make fails, it doesn't matter what you told it to do, it will simply stop because it can't load the make file. Because the dependency information, what's going on is every time GCC runs, there's a second command, actually it's no longer a second command because GCC has integrated this. But in addition to generating the .o file, it generates a file called, so suppose I'm generating build foo.o, okay? If you look very carefully at what the command does, you'll see a bunch of incantations would involve like a dash capital M in them. The .m file. The .m file, and by the way, the dot is here because usually when you list the output of the build directory, right, you'd get overwhelmed if all of these things showed up, so these are hidden. That basically says don't list them unless I say so. And this file is itself a makefile fragment. Okay? And what's going to be in there, if you look, is you're going to see something of the form, if you're trying to build foo.o, then you need foo.c, you need x.h and a.h, so forth. So this is so that if you change a header file, the right thing, and you don't do a make clean, the right things get built. So if you succeed at compiling to get a foo.o at all, we'll get the corresponding .foo.m. Once that .foo.m exists, if you look at the bottom of the makefiles, you'll see that all of the makefiles have at the bottom a dash include build slash dot star dot m. Actually, it's build dir. Please use the build dir variable. We reserve the right to change the name of the build directory. In particular, we're having debates back and forth about whether build should have an architecture-specific subdirectory. There's lots of stuff in the dependency structure that relies on that variable being used so we can rename it. Okay, well, what does this do? This says, take this makefile fragment and read it, whereupon it's as if you wrote this dependency explicitly in your makefile. Believe me, after a few hundred header files, you don't want to write these dependencies by hand. Dash says, well, attempt to include it, but don't whine too hard if you don't find it. If the file is absent, which is the case when you haven't built the tree yet, it'll still work fine. If the file is present and everything in it is sort of okay, it'll still work fine. The killer is, suppose you had some x.h which used to exist at the last time you built this file, but now it's gone away, like you renamed the file or you deleted it. Now you have a stale dependency information. And make is going to try to build this x.h and it's going to fail. Because there isn't a way to build x.h anymore. Make no depend is tricky because you are throwing away the dependency information. When you throw away the dependency information, now you may find that builds don't happen. Okay? So frankly, the safe thing to do when you do a no depend is also do a clean. That way all the dependencies will get regenerated. You have to clean the whole tree if you have a dependency problem. Usually you can just clean in the one directory. And I apologize for the opacity of the make files. It grew organically. Never mind. I'll know what happens on organic farms. I don't need to be explicit. And as complicated as they are, they're better than trying to maintain it by hand. That may seem hard to believe, but it's true. People run into specific issues with make files that have been kind of surprising that they want to talk about. Two people sent me notes saying, how do we hand this in? And the answer is, in spite of intentionally misleading you, I hadn't set a due date. So the answer is you don't yet. But here's my preference, I'm going to ask you to simply have under your home directory, I don't want to do this, you simply put your Kyotos tree under your home directory, we can clone it, and we will rebuild your tree. And then the question, it's hard to do a policy on that because 3 femtoseconds after you declare that you're done, there could be an updated tip that you haven't seen. Right? So we can't count against you. You're not 100%. Understand what the question is.
Zero.
Either works or it doesn't. All right. Let me qualify that. If we have a known bug in Capital that's been getting in our way or some other tool, right? And there's a chance that the code is basically right, but it was impeded by the need for a bug fix. So like what I did with Nate, right? Nate had this puzzle that he was trying to sort out. And it wasn't immediately obvious. And he had a tree of this form, and I cloned his tree, okay? And then it turns out you can, when you do a Mercurial call, or actually, if you run make update, you've seen it do an HG fetch. So HG fetch, and some of you, that probably didn't work the first time because you didn't actually create the HGRC. So HG fetch does a combination of HG pull followed by HG update. And if you don't tell pull where to pull from, it implicitly pulls from something called default. When you did HG clone, HG clone set up an HGRC in your workspace that said, well, unless told otherwise, the place to pull from is where I got the tree from originally. So HG fetch without any argument simply goes back to the published tree and gets whatever updates are there. What I did in Nate's case is I cloned the tree out of his home directory into my machine. So that way, if there was a trivial one-line fix, I could push it back into his repositories. And that didn't work. Right? So then what I did was I did a pull from the public tree because he wasn't quite up to date. And that merged the changes. So the answer to your, I think the right answer to your question is, look, we're just going to clone the tree. Whatever's committed is committed. If it doesn't work, we'll at least make attempts to merge the fixes and rebuild it. But it still doesn't work, and it doesn't work. Is that not addressing your, is that addressing your question? I mean,
I just wanted to make
sure you have a resolution on this. See, the question you're really asking is, so if when that's all over, we have something that doesn't work because there's a problem in the tree, then how do we deal with it? So I'm not inclined to cause anybody harm because there's broken code in the tree. What I want is a report saying something's not working. So this stuff is hard to debug. We've had a couple of cases of things where Scott's gotten involved and it's taken him several hours to figure out that there's something really strange going on. It's better to send me a note first. Go ahead and do the debug, right? But I may see what's going on, or I can clone your tree quickly, try to build it, and something may jump out at me, and then it's done. That doesn't mean you shouldn't look, because it may be your bug. The reason I want to get the bug reports as soon as possible is, if I'm working on fixing something on Monday, the chances of having it in, and then you being up all night Monday night to integrate it, are zero, because you're too smart to stay up all night doing homework that's due the next day, right? Oh. Maybe I'm wrong. Most of you are too smart to do that. You do that a few minutes ago?
Yes.
You're modern CS majors, right? That makes all the difference, right?
Oh. We don't have to sit inside a
cat. You don't have to sit inside a what?
Cat punching cards and...
Yeah. Don't need punch. Also, you don't need a heavily air-conditioned environment, which is really good because your hands get really stiff in those data centers. It's terrible.
Your experience.
It's very cold. Especially if you have a maladjusted air conditioner. It really can drive a room down to like 50 degrees. Okay. So I want to get the reports early because at least then I have a chance to work on something in time to help. And also, if something goes wrong, you know, then we at least have a pointer of where you thought you were stuck. I'd like to help, but we need something from you to be able to. Mostly what we need is early messages that say I'm stuck. Rather, basically, if you're starting a debugging process and it doesn't jump out at you in the first few minutes, what's wrong? You know how it is, right? You're debugging something, and there's a point at which you say, okay. This isn't going to be obvious. Send a note at that point. Don't stop debugging, but send a note at that point. Because it may be more obvious to me just because I've had more opportunity to be burned than you have. Scott is now entering that category too. He's getting really good at being burned by this tree. Just don't wait until Friday or Saturday night. That won't work. I mean, the problem with working on a live tree is it is a moving target. We need time to react to problems. We'll react given the time, but you've got to let us react. Okay, now the other half of how do I hand it in is, so where should my test cases live? This case, one of the things I have to do is I have to figure out a directory structure. So my guess is most of you have put your null stream implementation either under, probably under drivers, I'm guessing. That's actually not probably the right place for it. And what I should do is I should set up a subtree that can be used for your own stuff. We actually have a mechanism for that because we have clients who are doing their own code that needs to integrate into our build system. We don't want it in our tree because it's not our code. But the make files already have a convention for dealing with that. We can maybe use that for this class. Basically, at the Kyoto source level, just like there's base, If you put a directory there that's called lowercase var dot anything at all, makefile will recurse into it just as it does into base. So you can build a subtree structure there. What I will do, because I have to do this anyway for a client, I will create a template directory of that form. It'll show you what the layout will look like. And you'll probably have to migrate your files into it. But that way it'll be in a well-defined. And the other thing we could do is we could put a, leave it in the driver directory. Is that easier for people? We put the test cases in the test directory. The reason I hesitate is, at some point we're going to declare the null stream and zero stream exercise to be over, at which point I can actually put in official versions of null stream and zero stream, and I want to put this in standard locations, and I'm going to want to put a test case down in the test directory. They won't live in the driver directory, that's okay. But I think the real issue there is to get the test case named something that won't collide. So let me think about that, and I'll get a note out tonight. So you know what's coming, my plan is essentially to call a halt to the null stream and IO stream exercise tomorrow or Thursday. And at that point, we will release the official versions, or at least reference versions, and then have you guys go ahead forward on the pipe implementation. The idea with doing null stream and then zero stream was you do null stream first, which should have been the least number of things to collide with, and should have gotten you, that was the idea, right? Zero stream would get you involved in doing a little bit of actual I.O. Some people have a working null stream at this point, people did not. How many of the people who did not have been talking to Scott? How many of you are working alone? So the intention was to do partners in projects. I said that, but it didn't emphasize it. Even said at one point, wander out into the hall and figure out who your partner is during the break. I actually did. It's not a bad experience to wrestle. Look, so we'll start the partner thing now if people want to do it. You're not obligated to do it. The exercise of wading through this yourself is actually not a bad exercise to do. All know that some partners are more equal, at times that works in your favor, and sometimes well. So, if you choose a partner, how many of you have no idea who it would be? Let's just say partner would be in deep trouble. I'm really lucky. I mean, the sad part is I'm really lucky if I get in one day of code a week.
How many hours?
Eight. Are you asking my ego, or are you asking reality? All joking aside, I probably am. I probably am five times more effective than most of the programmers out there. I know people who are a lot more effective than I am. No, it's just that we're going through a phase of administrivia, right? It's the end of the year. You have to review your insurance policies, stuff like that. It takes an inordinate amount of time. Okay, why don't we do this? It's now 3:10. Okay. Instead of our usual 5-minute break, let's take a 10-minute break and let me ask you to try to figure out who your partner should be for the stuff that's coming up. We'll do it here because we're all here, more or less, and figure that out. Nice thing about using Mercurial is you have all of the necessary mechanisms to sure work. So let's take a 10-minute break and do that, and then we will return and go through the other half of the invocation pack.